This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It is just a great pleasure to be back on campus. It's been a while since I've been here, see so many good friends, and I want to really thank so many of you for reaching out and providing opportunities for me to connect with colleagues, with students, and have some interesting conversations over the next few days and into the next week. I'm really honored to be invited to give the Hitchcock lectures. I'm looking forward to those. It's given me an opportunity to sort of step back and reflect on what we did in the last 4 years that I was in the White House. I am a marine ecologist by training. I'm an academic. Despite growing up in Colorado, I fell in love with the ocean and became a marine ecologist and have just been so excited about the discovery element of science. Science is fun, and I really went into it because of that. I've also come to appreciate how important science is in our lives and how important it is to help us understand our world, our place in it, and inform the decisions we make, whether those decisions are by individuals or by institutions. Over time, I became more and more involved in communicating science to the public and to policymakers, and ended up, as Vince told you, leading NOAA for the first term of the Obama administration, and then more recently, the last 4 years in the White House, serving as the Deputy Director for Climate and Environment. What I'm going to talk to you about today is very much those 4 years and how what we did to begin integrating, based on science, solutions to big challenges, including climate change, loss of biodiversity or nature, and inequity and inequality. So let's dive in. I have, if this was a scientific paper, we'd start with an abstract. If it was, if we were doing a science communications thing, we'd start with key messages. But because this is a government talk, we're going to start with a government acronym, BLUF, bottom line up front. So this is your BLUF for today. These are the take-home messages. So the three challenges that I'm focusing on today are intimately interconnected. Instead of treating them as silos, it's quite possible to integrate solutions to them. And doing that can make for better outcomes. And doing so, the way we did it during the last 4 years, I believe really provides not only proof of concept, but models to emulate and a pathway forward that can now be taken up and combined with other integration opportunities and provide opportunities for us to continue the important work of tackling these challenges. Because despite the craziness and insanity that's underway in Washington, D.C. right now, the challenges loom large, and we can't not continue to make progress on them. The Office of Science and Technology Policy. This is obviously the White House. Here's the West Wing, seen here. And right here is the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is where most of the people who work in the White House actually are located. There are hundreds of people, and they are in this really spectacular building. The mission of the Office of Science and Technology Policy is to really bring science into the policy conversations. And that is achieved both through the people who are in OSTP, as well as an external advisory committee called the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology Policy,
and which Inez Fung and Saul Perlmutter from UC Berkeley have participated. But it also is led, the team that's at OSTP is led by a series of deputies, of which I was one. Your colleague, Deirdre Mulligan, led the tech team. Another colleague of ours led the energy team, and there were a number of teams in the building. So OSTP really focuses on science for policy as well as policy for science, and both of those are equally important. There are science champions, not only in the White House, starting at the top. President Biden was really excited about science. He loved to hear about science, and he always wanted to know, what does the science say about something? But throughout members of his cabinet, there was keen interest in science. And so in the administration, the last 4 years, as in some previous administrations, there's a real keen appetite for science and having decisions be informed by science. Now, because for the first time ever, OSTP in the Biden administration was a cabinet-level position, it actually had a lot more access and interaction with various members of the administration than previously. The president set a strong tone from the outset to base policies on science and evidence, to focus on scientific integrity and strengthen it, and that was true within the administration and as advised by PCAST. And then the teams within the Office of Science and Technology Policy focused on different topical areas. And so again, the one that I led was focused on climate and the environment. That team, the climate and environment team, was amazing. They were spectacular people, averaged about 25 people rotated through during for different periods of time, either coming from academia or from office agencies that would detail people over to the White House. We also partnered with a lot of other teams in the White House. For example, in Office of Management and Budget, OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Analysis, very powerful organization within the White House, or John Podesta's team that was focused on clean energy and climate, Brenda Mallory, who is the chair of the Council on Environmental Quality, John Kerry, who is the president's special envoy for climate, and this team of people interacted with these folks a lot, and because of that, we were able to get a lot done and have the science that we were bringing welcomed by and infused into the policies that were being led either by our team or by other teams. Our particular team, the Climate and Environment team, was really focused on a series of teams that were very porous. We had an ocean team, a nature team, a climate team, a polar, indigenous engagement and knowledge, and environmental health and equity. I'm going to focus only on a subset of that today because we don't have time to talk about everything that we did. With that context, I want to focus on three interrelated challenges. You all know climate change is underway. It is a major threat to our way of life. So too is loss of biodiversity or nature. And so too is the increasing inequity and inequality, not only in the US, but throughout the world. Each of these challenges is often thought of as distinct. We know that climate change is causing more and more problems. I need not tell all of you that. It's pretty clear, pretty obvious. Less well known to many people is the significant loss of biodiversity. You see on this slide that the rates of increase in extinctions, that extinctions are increasing very dramatically more recently. And we also know that these three affect one another. For example, nature loss exacerbates climate change. And in this particular figure, the loss of nature, for example, here as seen by overhunting, of Brazilian tapirs, of green-billed toucans, black-faced tamarins, gray brocket deer. In this tropical forest, overhunting causes those species to disappear. They forage primarily on the very large fruits that fall to the ground, and those large fruits are produced primarily by trees that just happen to store a lot more carbon than do the trees that produce smaller fruits. And so the trees that produce these large fruits are really, really important to the climate system. And as populations of these large mammals decline, they no longer are dispersing large fruits. And so the abundance of the high carbon storage trees declines, and the forest is dominated by these soft wood species. On the right-hand side, the soft wood tree species that store less carbon are the ones that are dominant. So just one specific example of how nature loss and climate change are interconnected with one another. And there are hundreds of stories like this. So too is environmental justice connected with climate change and with nature loss. Climate change can increase natural disasters, and these natural disasters play out disproportionately to the people who have contributed the least to those problems. And poor countries are experiencing a lot greater impacts of climate change than are others. So we have three different topics, three different global challenges. They are typically treated as silos. There's a whole community of climate policy people. There's a whole different community of biodiversity policy people. There's a whole separate community of inequity, inequality, or environmental justice people. They have separate conventions, separate meetings. They don't interact. Those people don't, and often the policies don't. And so we have siloed approaches to these problems that are actually highly interconnected. And so part of what we wanted to do in the White House was to begin connecting those in ways that I will describe to you. So despite the fact that they are siloed, they don't have to be. It is possible to embed, for example, environmental justice and climate and nature in climate solutions. Or it's possible to embed nature and climate in EJ solutions, or climate and EJ in nature solutions. And so instead of trying to lump everything together and try to interconnect it all, that's just not realistic. Our approach was to do this embedding. And I'm going to give you a few examples of how we did each of those to show that it's not only possible, but actually results in better policies. So again, the whole purpose here is to align policy with our scientific knowledge. And our knowledge tells us the solutions need to be integrated. So, number one, we incorporated new knowledge to embed nature and EJ into climate policies. Now, the we in this case, a lot of what I'm going to talk about was led by the folks in the climate and environment team, working very seamlessly and closely with the federal agencies, with lots of partners outside of the government, and with many of the other offices that I've already mentioned. So this climate and environment team, which did include one of your colleagues, yay, Ron Cohen here. We also have two other colleagues who are here today, Anne-Marie Carlton from UC Irvine, and I think Phil Duffy is here, two other colleagues who are on our team. And that was the climate and environment team. A subset of those were the U.S. Global Change Research Program team, and they were really responsible for a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about. Now, the Biden-Harris administration made tackling climate change a major, major centerpiece of the administration and made historic progress in tackling climate change. Many of the things that you see that are the headlines are what you see on this slide. The commitments that were made, the action that was made, was, by all accounts, historic and really, really important. Most of that focused on the kinds of things that people think of when they hear climate solution, which is going to be technology, clean energy, and those are all there. But there's a lot more. This is the tip of the iceberg. And what I'm going to tell you about is what's below the tip of the iceberg, which is what makes it all work. So traditional climate policy really focuses on these kinds of things. It's focused on mitigation. It's focused on reducing emissions, technology-centric, focused on where we live and work and play on land, and it relies on EPA's inventory, which is an estimate of how many what the greenhouse gas concentrations are likely to be in the atmosphere. We brought a more holistic approach to climate policy, which is focused not only on mitigation, but also adaptation. For example, with the Climate Resilience Framework and Strategy, which described a new approach to doing that kind of integration and bringing a lot of new resources to the table through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act, which had a lot of money for adaptation and resilience, and also bringing in the EJ component through an initiative called J40, Justice 40, which ensures that 40% of the resources that are spent, that the benefits that accrue from the resources that are spent go to disadvantaged communities. So adding adaptation into mitigation was a key element of what this embedding process was. Another was to focus not just on reducing emissions, but the need for us to remove carbon from the atmosphere or from the ocean, which then in turn removes it from the atmosphere. And so an example of that is the recognition that to do this kind of carbon removal requires better understanding. And for the ocean in particular, we don't know enough to know which of the different multiple options there are for removing carbon dioxide from the ocean will actually work. And therefore, we identified what are the key, most important research priorities for marine CDR so that we can know more what's effective and what impact that is on the marine ecosystem. So both how long does it last and if it can be done safely. The people who were responsible for that, we had a marine CDR team that were working on that. Technology is critically important, but so too is working with nature. And we had a whole portfolio of activities on nature-based solutions. We created a roadmap for nature-based solutions that was announced at one of the climate COPs. We also created new rules that guide the agencies in making their decisions. Whenever agencies have to make a decision about spending money or resources, whenever they do anything, they have to do a benefit-cost analysis. And until the change that I'm going to describe to you is made, the rules specified that this benefit-cost analysis would be done in a way that we knew how to do 30 years ago. It had not been updated for 30 years. And it included, for example, the costs of doing something, but never any of the benefits. For example, there was no inclusion of ecosystem services, the benefits that nature provides. And so when an agency would have to make a decision, for example, about, let's say the Corps of Engineers was making a decision about what to do with the dredge spoils when it dredges the Mississippi River. It could take those dredge spills, put them on a boat, take it out to the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and dump it. Or it could take it and put it right at the edge of the delta and help rebuild the delta that is disappearing. That benefit-cost analysis in the old days would say, take it out to the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and dump it there because that's the cheapest thing to do. This new law, this new guidance from OMB, Office of Management and Budget, two agencies, says that when you do benefit cost analysis now, you must include ecosystem services. And so rebuilding that wetland provides a wealth of benefits that dumping into the ocean doesn't do. And so giving credit for ecosystem services allows a much more balanced approach to making federal decisions. So that's an example of aligning policy with current knowledge. And now we have the economic tools to value ecosystem services, which we didn't 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so, and again, examples of updating policies based on current knowledge. So this benefit cost analysis includes ecosystem services, and it includes ways to value ecosystem services. And then also much of the resources that were in these two major pieces of legislation include money for doing nature-based solutions. Land-based approaches, the ocean is also a huge solution to climate change, not just a victim of climate change. And in fact, our analyses suggested that there is no path to net zero that doesn't go through the ocean. And so a whole series of opportunities for ocean-based solutions were identified through an ocean climate action plan, and the EJ component brought in through an ocean justice strategy, and also a new strategy that focuses on the kind of EJ data that we don't have now that we need. So that was a whole package of ocean activities. Estimating greenhouse gases, I said, was what we have relied on, but wouldn't it be a lot better to actually just measure those instead of estimating and hoping that you were making the right estimates? So that's what Ron Cohen was working on. He was brought in as the director of the office to oversee this integration across multiple agencies to actually do the measurements. So we have a measuring, monitoring, reporting, and verification strategy and implementation. So putting this all together, we have gone from the traditional climate policy over on the left to more holistic climate policy by adding a lot of components that should be there and that actually make the outcomes much better. And on the right, Biden-Harris administration examples of each of those, not exhaustive, just examples. That in turn leads to more effective climate policy. In addition to embedding nature and EJ into the climate policies, they were both also more front and center in climate communications. And I'll give you two examples. One is the fifth National Climate Assessment, which was released in 2023, and it focuses on impacts of climate change, what kind of mitigation and adaptation are underway across the country. There's an atlas, so you can actually go and see your community and pull up climate information about your community. There's an art by climate juried competition that has spectacular art that if you haven't seen it, you should check out. And the whole thing was translated into Spanish to make it more accessible. Quite a few Berkeley folks participated, contributed in the National Climate Assessment. Thank you, to you. There were nearly 500 authors of this National Climate Assessment, an additional 250 technical experts that contributed to it. So a huge, huge amount of effort. In addition to the National Climate Assessment, there are a whole suite of other climate services or data, information, and products about climate that enable communities or businesses to plan. A lot of effort was made to make these more accessible, more usable, more understandable, more relevant to the decisions that people are making. For example, by providing one-stop shopping through the Climate Mapping and Resilience for Resilience and Adaptation, or CAMRA portal. So you don't need to know which agency has what kind of information. You go to one place, to this camera portal, and you can find things. So one-stop shopping for climate services. There's a new tool that is still in progress that is super exciting, which is called Climate Resilience Information System, or CRIS, that we hope will still be able to be done, but it provides much more timely, downscaled information from the big climate models that will be much more useful to people in ways that aren't available at present. So the result of this integration of nature and EJ into climate is climate outcomes. We have better solutions. So that's part one. The second example that I want to give you is incorporating new knowledge to enable us to embed climate and EJ into nature policies. And again, this is bringing policy, making it current by infusing new knowledge that comes from all of you and elsewhere around the country and the world. The Nature team was largely responsible for a lot of this, and we worked with close colleagues in multiple other agencies. Seen on the left-hand side here are three of the individuals that led those offices or agencies: Secretary Raimondo of Commerce, and she is announcing one of the major cornerstone issues that we worked on, which was putting nature on the economic balance sheet of the country, or the national natural capital accounting. In the middle here is Secretary Deb Haaland, Secretary of the Interior, and she's announcing the new effort to create a new assessment, the National Nature Assessment, for the first time ever to take stock of nature in the country. And then at the bottom is Chair Brenda Mallory, head of the Council on Environmental Quality in the White House, and she is announcing the launching of a new effort to create nature-based solutions roadmap, which I already described to you. We work closely with John Podesta on a lot of this, and he totally understood the importance of nature to climate solutions, as did Ricky Revez of OMB. And so that team, what I'm doing and showing you all these people is to emphasize that it's people that are doing this work and that these are integrated efforts across all these different offices. So to achieve that integration focused on nature, we need to take a step back. When most people think about addressing the loss of biodiversity, how to stem the decline of biodiversity, those increased extinction rates that you saw in that graph, the focus that most people go to is protected areas. And the president ran on a pledge of protecting 30% of the lands in the ocean by 2030, so-called 30 by 30. Critically important are protected areas, but they alone are not going to stem the loss of biodiversity. We need other approaches in concert. So protected areas are critically important. They're necessary, but not sufficient. And so what we took was not a 30% approach, but a 100% approach, which says we really need to better understand the drivers of the loss of biodiversity, the loss of nature. So that's going to be habitat loss, it's overfishing and destructive fishing gear in the ocean, it's invasive species, it's climate change. Those are the major drivers on land and in the ocean. And we need to recognize what's at stake and connect the dots for people between loss of nature and human health, between loss of nature and the economy, or national security, or equity, or climate change. So how do we deal with that? Well, first and foremost, we started the long process, 15-year-long process, of putting nature on the economic balance sheet of the country. Now, if you look at the indicators that we have of the economy, it's jobs, GDP, inflation. We don't have any indicators that tell us how nature is doing. And yet, the economy depends ultimately on nature. But we don't have any signals. We don't have any economic signals of how it's changing. So we are in the process of creating natural capital accounts and associated environmental economic statistics that will talk seamlessly to the existing economic accounts. Now, we didn't figure out how to do GDP in a year or 2 years. It took 10 years to figure out how to measure GDP. So by extension, this is a little more complicated, although we know how to do it. And so the process that we designed is now we're moving along this process, and it continues today, of putting nature on the economic balance sheet of the country. There are 15 different accounts. They will tell us different things and give us the kind of information we need to plan. Secondly, we are including nature's benefits in the benefit cost analysis that federal agencies do, and I've already described that one to you. This is in very nerdy government speak. OMB Circular A4 and OMB Circular A94 are the two key pieces, the documents that tell agencies how to do their benefit cost analysis, and they now include this direction to include ecosystem services, how to value them, and they have other things critically important about discount rates and distributional analyses and other things. Three, recognize the importance of natural security, recognizing that that nature affects national security. And so for the first time ever, the U.S. National Security Strategy, which guides everything that the intelligence, defense, and security communities do, the National Security Strategy now includes biodiversity, climate change, polar regions. So natural security is now a thing within that community. Three more things we did. One is to initiate the National Nature Assessment, taking stock of the nature that we have in this country. How is it changing? What does it matter? How does it affect health? How does it affect the economy, et cetera? And what might be done? That process was 2 years along, two more years left, and it was stopped by the new administration. A group of people are picking up the pieces and figuring out how to keep it going. Of the 168 authors of that National Nature Assessment, only 20% were federal authors. Those folks may no longer work on it. They were given a stop work order. But the non-feds can continue. And some of those non-feds are some of your colleagues. And so they and we are in conversation about what this might look like, how we might do it. So this is a work in progress. But I can tell you, there is a huge amount of interest and enthusiasm in continuing some of the very, very critically important work that was initiated that has now been stopped. So take heart from the fact that people are not giving up and walking away, and that we will see how successful we are, but I'm very hopeful. The fifth thing I want to highlight for you in this bucket is to remove the impediments for nature-based solutions. And the nature-based roadmap did that, and we are actually making good headway in doing that through things like highlighting the importance, having more resources available, having the kind of policies that encourage nature-based solutions so that, in fact, they are the go-to, the default, as opposed to maybe an afterthought. And then finally, elevate the importance of nature to health and equity. So all six of those were mainstreaming nature across federal policies and practices in ways that had never been done before and that are actually really, really exciting. So this piece alone, I think, is landmark in terms of how the substance of the individual pieces, but how they complement one another and will help get us to a place where we have more effective and efficient nature outcomes. The third bucket is to incorporate new knowledge to embed nature and climate in EJ policies. And because these are all interconnected, I've already told you about some of these. But let me start by saying that the key people in this were not only on our teams in the White House and in the agencies, but working in close collaboration with EJ experts who have both lived experience and scholarship in these areas, a few of whom are shown on this image. And this was the Rose Garden signing of the where the president signed the executive order on environmental justice, with his signing on the left, and then just a shot from where I was sitting, looking over the heads of folks who were they were who were assembled there. So embedding climate and nature in EJ policies was very much done in this Justice 40 initiative. Providing meaningful opportunities for people affected by policies to participate in decisions that impact their health and environment, for example, through the Ocean Justice Strategy, addressing significant gaps in information that we have and knowledge that we have that hinder decisions through this EJ Science, Data, and Research Plan, and recognizing and elevating the importance of indigenous knowledge. Federal agencies are required by law to make their decisions on science and evidence. The guidance that we issued from the White House instructs those agencies to also consider indigenous knowledge where it's relevant to decisions, and it spells out the process of engaging with indigenous knowledge holders and tribes and tribal entities in a way that is respectful, appropriate, and non-extractive. So I've talked about sort of three interconnected pathways for doing this embedding to have more holistic outcomes, more durable outcomes that work better for people, for the climate, for nature. We've integrated policy and action in ways that I think are historically ambitious, based in science, and designed to be sticky, to persist despite things that are happening. Now, I've mentioned a few that have been undone because they were noted in EOs. Other things continue. Time will tell how many of those other things are undone, but I think the fact that they were initiated and many of them are going to persist because they are important to folks across the land will be really, really critically important. We've incorporated them into economic policies and into national security policies. And so not only did we pay attention to mandates, things like regulations, but to incentives, which are critically important. And you have seen in the bipartisan infrastructure law, in the Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of the incentives for new actions are what is really, I think, going to be durable, not just regs. So incentives and regs, carrots and sticks together, can be a powerful combination. And then significant new resources through the bill and IRA. And the end result, I think, has been we have just begun to see the benefits of these. And so I hope some of those benefits will continue to play out and become obvious. As John Podesta has noted many, many times, as ambitious as all of this work is, it's not all that's needed. It's a down payment. And now we are forced with a situation where even that is increasingly challenging. And that makes it all the more important to recognize what has been done and to help keep much of it underway as much as possible. So bringing this to close to a close, I want to return to my bottom line up front and talk about how interconnected these three major global challenges are, the fact that we can integrate solutions to these, and I've shown you many examples, and that doing so really provides proof of concept. It is possible to do that integration. It's not just kind of arm waving. And it provides a roadmap and opportunities now to pass the baton from the federal government to states, from the federal government to community, from the federal government to religious organizations, to businesses, because now is not the time to stop with this work. It needs to continue and it needs to accelerate. One example of that was the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, of which I am a member, and the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences inform policies of the Vatican. Pope Francis is very respectful of science. He wants to know what science says, and he wants to make his decisions to be informed by science. And he is committed to this integration of climate and nature and EJ. And that's it sort of speaks to him. And through a number of symposia that we've had over the years, this integration has become more and more embedded in what the Vatican is doing. And so last May, the Pope convened a summit entitled From Climate Crisis to Climate Resilience. And it focused not on what national governments are doing, but on what sub-national governments are doing. And so some of the people who were at the conference, for example, were mayors and governors. Your governor was there, as was the governor of Massachusetts, the governor of New York, and governors from dozens of other cities and other entities around the globe. Every inhabited continent had mayors and governors present at this meeting. It was so inspiring to see all of the work that is underway. I had no idea all the things that are being done, and it varies from one place to another. And if anyone is sort of down about how hard a lot of this is, we need only look to what is actually happening to be inspired and to get ideas about what else could be happening. And so the baton is being passed in our country now from the national government, from the federal government, to subnational governments, to states, to cities, but also to the private sector and to tribes around the country. Also at this Vatican summit, there was huge presence of young people with huge, great ideas. And a lot of indigenous leaders like Chief Rayoni of the Kayapo people, the largest indigenous group in the Amazon. You can see your governor here and your Secretary of Natural Resources here. Here's the governor of Massachusetts. And this gentleman, Ram Ramanathan from UC San Diego, member of the Pontifical Academy, was the one who organized this along with Cardinal Turkson, and Joachim, who is the president of the Pontifical Academy, and Sister Helen is the president of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. That summit was so inspiring to everybody there that the group decided, and Ram again has been leading the charge, to organize a series of regional summits to inspire even more action and to have others see what is being done. And so a whole series of regional summits are happening, the first one of which was last week here in California, and it was hosted by the Governor's Office of Land Use and Climate Innovation, University of California, and the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Social Sciences. And so this one was called Climate Resilience for California and Californians, CRC2. That included a number of your colleagues who were both helped with the planning. Dave is here. I don't know if Luis is here, but a number, yep, great, great, thank you. Glad you're here. Thank you for this. It was really, really great. And a number of your other colleagues. So a whole series of other regional events are happening. You can see some of the cities here where they are being planned, and this is all over in the period of the next year. So in wrapping up, I want you to feel inspired by not only what we did, but but about how the time has come to pass the baton. And I remember that the first time the U.S. withdrew from the Paris Agreement, which was announced that we would do so in 2017, mayors and governors around this country stood up and said, "We are still in." Now what we're hearing is, "We can do this." Every fraction of a degree matters. Every species matters. Every person matters. And understanding that the urgency of this, understanding that time is wasting, understanding that there is momentum, I think now is the time for us to take that baton and run like the wind. This is a time for agency. This is a time for urgency. This is a time for hope. Yes, things are tough. Yes, things are challenging. Yes, there's new insanity that's announced every day about horrible stuff that's happening. But this is not the time to give up. This is the time for us to stand up, take that baton, and run like the wind. Thank you very much.
Hi, Dr. Lipchenko. I'm Kathy Rye. I was a resident here 35 years ago in the 90s, so it's nice to be back, and I totally hear you about seeing friends. The quick question is, we were very hopeful as young people when George Shultz came and talked about how James Baker promised Gorbachev that we will not expand NATO one inch past where it is now, but 14 countries later, and ballooning defense spending budgets, and the military does spew more than half the carbon ever, like more than industry, more than residences, more than commercial, more than the civilian. As a cabinet member, did you have a chance to talk to the Secretary of State about reducing the spending, not dropping bombs? Please, just, they can make the money, drop teddy bears, stop hurting people. So we were so hopeful. So that's just my question to you. So I'm probably hitting a lot of third rails. You're not supposed to touch defense spending, all that other crap. But anyway, that's my question.
Thank you. So to be clear, I was not in the cabinet. My boss was, Arthi Prabhakar. Nonetheless, I did interact with a lot of the various secretaries and others, and certainly have done so across many, many years. Much of the, starting in the first Obama administration and continuing in his second, and then also during the Biden administration, the military was very concerned about climate change and really stepped up to begin addressing its own climate footprint and to pioneer new ways to be much more efficient and effective in what they are doing. That's not addressing your question about the size of the budget or what else it's used for, but I think you should know that there is increased appreciation for the importance of climate change in the security world, in the defense world, and the need for them to be part of the solution, not just part of the problem.
Thank you very much, Sean Clare. When I think about how we got into this situation, I think about society needing things and then having negative externalities to things like transportation, to things like energy production and industry, things that were anticipated or unanticipated, but which created disparities for people or greenhouse gas emissions and things. And when I think about some of the technological solutions to the climate crisis, I think the same thing is potentially at risk of happening, whether we're talking about ocean acidification or stratospheric ozone loss or disproportionate impacts to people from resource extraction to build batteries and things like that. So how do you think your kind of integrated framework can help us hopefully not make some of the same mistakes now that we made when we, started the oil-based economy and things like that to do things that we needed to do?
So lots of complications in a lot of what you talked about, right? Part of the goal of putting nature on the balance sheet is to do a better job of understanding consequences of action to things that we care about. And having more information to make some of those externalities appear on the balance sheet. And so that's not that you can put a number on everything, but having information where you can compare different choices is actually very valuable in making smarter decisions. Not that everything can be done that way, but that will help. So that's just a very specific example of how having a balance sheet that actually is complete as opposed to just having one side is an exciting new development that I think will help in addressing some of the problems that you've identified.
Thank you. National Academy of Sciences issued a report recently, and it included what I perceive to be a positive outcome or a positive response on iron fertilization in the ocean for purposes of creating more food, sequestering carbon, and inequities, improving inequities around the globe. Have you had an opportunity to look at iron fertilization and what do you think about it right now?
So part of what this issue is all about is recognizing that significant portions of the ocean are nutrient limited, oftentimes by nitrogen, and that by essentially dropping iron filings in those parts of the ocean, the idea was that you could stimulate the growth of the microscopic plants in the ocean. They would take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and would essentially, I'll make this simpler, and the end result would be sequestering some of that carbon into the deep sea. So the idea was that iron fertilization was proposed as a way to remove carbon from the ocean and therefore from the atmosphere. The Academy report that you referred to examined a whole series of different options for removing carbon from the ocean. Iron fertilization is one of them. Ocean alkalinity is another one. There are various ways that you can increase upwelling or increase downwelling. There are about six different commonly thought of possible approaches to carbon dioxide removal from the ocean. The reason that we started the Marine Carbon Dioxide Removal Research Priority Plan was explicitly because we said we don't know enough to know if any of these can be done safely or effectively. And iron fertilization is one of the ones about which there are very significant questions. We do know from a lot of experiments that have been done that it does stimulate short-term the growth of phytoplankton, but that you get different types of phytoplankton than you would get otherwise, and therefore you get different types of zooplankton and different types of fishes, and so there are ecosystem impacts that are difficult. And by the way, you have to continue it for a long time. You can't just stop it. So there are a lot of questions about not only that, but all of the other ideas that people have about how might we remove carbon dioxide from the ocean. So the bottom line is, we don't know enough. We need more research, which is why the report that we produced said, here are the research priorities. Let's get the information so we can be smarter about making decisions before we do something that's really stupid.
Hi, I'm Eric. I'm a PhD student here. One of the things that I'm struck by listening to you speak is your general tone of optimism. And I must admit that I, like many students and faculty members here at Berkeley, have been somewhat mired in, I don't know, despair. Maybe that's the right word. How do you this is a philosophical question. How do you find yourself remaining hopeful and optimistic in the times that we're going through today?
It is really tough because, you know, when you know a lot about something, you see how hard it is. And I get that. And I am just horrified by a lot of the things that are underway right now. I wouldn't want anybody to have any other impression. On the other hand, I've been around long enough that I have seen where sometimes when really challenging things happen, people stand up, which is what we're seeing now, and what we saw in the first time the current president was president, states and cities stood up and did all sorts of things that they hadn't done before, and they realized, okay, we've got the baton now, we've got to make stuff happen. The private sector stood up, they made good things happen. Yes, now is different. Yes, some of the challenges are even worse, but we can't not try, right? And so one of the things that we need to do is acknowledge that climate despair is real and not try to paper over that. It's daunting, but at the same time, there are things that we can do. And if you had gone to this CRC2 symposium that was last week, I was blown away by the amazing things that are happening in this state, by so many different communities, by different universities, and students were involved in a lot of that. And so global action and the thinking that we have to do it at the global scale is part of the despair and part of the discouragement. If you can sort of start locally and see, and then that can spread. And, you know, I think it's useful to know that social systems are as highly nonlinear as our biogeophysical systems. And so the question is, what is it going to take to get us to tipping points? And that's going to be a lot of work that sort of goes and goes and goes, and you don't see a lot of progress, then all of a sudden you can reach a tipping point. And so that's, I think, what we need to challenge ourselves with. How do we get to those tipping points? And it's not enough for scientists to just wave the science flag. We have to demonstrate to people why it matters, how it's useful, tell stories, talk about the work in ways that they see benefit. And that's part of what I think is happening in this country right now, is that people don't see their lives being better, and that's what they are responding to. And so showing and working across partisan divides, not just staying in our own little silos, but really trying to connect with neighbors and to find common ground, find ways forward, not just asserting, but demonstrating why science, why information is useful.
Hello, thank you so much for the very nice lecture. It was really a kind of mind-changing, you know, and I'm really proud that your last name is looks like from the country where I am from. Oleksiy Buyagyi. I'm from Ukraine originally, and I was really excited to hear the lecture. But the question is, according to the U.S. Energy Information Agency, the demand for the electricity is 100 terawatt hours a year. And most of this energy, electricity goes to data centers, housing, and transportation. As well, I would add actually that it goes also for the water desalination, the vast amount of electricity that goes to reverse osmosis. In the same time, we are just less than 2 hours away from the one of the largest source of the so-called petrothermal energy source that is not being used yet for running the data centers. In the same time, there are a lot of opportunities and a lot of technologies that allows to desalinate the water without using the electricity, and in the same time solving the problems that you just recently talked about. I tell about the upwelling, natural upwelling, that will help also the nutrients and biodiversity to grow up, and as well as capture the carbon from the air. But there are a certain kind of a lobby that doesn't allow the new technologies to come up on the market. And what would you advise to the startups? What is the best way how to promote the new technologies, how to make them available to the US, and how it's possible to deploy them in a better way? Because it looks like it's too conservative community, too conservative governance, too bureaucratic in order to promote something new, to demonstrate something new. And it's always challenging for the young age startups to deliver something. Thank you.
So I'm not sure I know enough about the specifics to offer any useful guidance. I do appreciate that new technologies are harder to get sort of underway. That's tough regardless of where you are. That's tough around the world. And having the proof of concept is important. This is also where government policies, whether they're at the national level or at the state level, can be really, really important because they can incentivize new things. And that was one of the things that was changed in the Biden administration was incentivizing renewable clean energies that had been discouraged because of previous policies through incentives. And so government policies can be helpful in that regard, but I hope that's helpful.
My name is Adrienne Correa, and you mentioned that the baton is being passed from the federal government to other sectors in terms of responding to these challenges. And I was just wondering if you have any specific suggestions for academic scientists or biologists who in the transition, in this baton passing, to make sure that they are plugged in so that scientific knowledge is aligning with policy quickly.
Yep. Thanks for that question. It's really tough. There's so much that's happening so fast. You know, in the news, we hear all about, you know, all the people being fired and policies being revoked. There is a ton that is underway that is responding to that, but it's hard to keep track of it. So I would highlight professional scientific societies who are really, you know, especially the ones that are more politically savvy and active as you know, they are stepping up. They are providing, so a lot of, I sort of think about this in three buckets. One is protecting people, protecting programs, protecting data. And there are activities in all three of those arenas that are underway now. Companies are some companies are stepping up, some philanthropies are stepping up, some institutions are stepping up. But I think for academic scientists, the professional scientific societies and NGOs that are science respectful are probably the best bet for, or any philanthropies that you happen to know and work with. Because they're all saying, okay, what can we do? How can we help? They're all talking to each other. They're working and providing, there is a lot that's underway. And so you need a pathway to tap into that. Kate, do you have any suggestions for her? Come up to the microphone. Kate's living in this world right now.
Sorry, can you sort of restate where you want me to jump in on all of the things?
Yeah, what would you advise?
Kate, I'm happy to talk to you.
This is Kate Wing. What would you advise to an academic scientist who wants to sort of know how can they get plugged into what's happening right now? In terms of response.
Oh, in terms of response. So I would say there's two things, and I want to speak to your themes of agency, urgency, and hope. The first is, as you said, there is this sense that things are very, very bad right now, and there's a lot of bad things going on that you have to think about. This is a long game. This is not just 4 years. This is rebuilding and reimagining things that we're going to have to build that took years to build, and that we need to take time to reimagine how to build them better and forward and in a more integrated way like you were talking about. So I encourage a lot of people to take a breath and think about what they're really good at and dig into that vertical and figure out how they're going to use that to imagine the future, whether it's investing in startups or connecting with people in other disciplines and writing down and sharing those stories of the future we want to live into, because we need those stories. That's what's going to help sustain us moving forward. And I don't just mean, you know, evocative stories. I mean, like, practical stories about how we are going to fund ocean observation for the next 20 years. The second thing I would say is that there are groups out there that are organizing. You are starting to see the professional scientific societies, AGUs, the AAAS groups out there starting to say, yes, we can't just sit by and let scientific expertise disappear from the public square. So that is a great place to get involved, and it's also a place that, frankly, I think those societies need to be pushed, because they have often said they are very reluctant to do activism, but now is a time where if science and evidence aren't at the table, then they aren't really here in American society right now. So if you are a member of those societies, if you're thinking of being a member of those societies, make sure that they're standing up for science and finding ways to stand up for science. And then if there are other more specific ways that you want to think about getting involved in, like, data preservation or models or other types of activism, I'm happy to talk to people in the side frame. But just know that there, if you were part of the Stand Up for Science march here at Berkeley or anywhere else, you saw people standing up, and there are people who are going to keep standing up and finding new ways to stand up and say, knowing what goes on, understanding what goes on, and engaging based on evidence and science is important. And people are doing it, and we're going to keep doing it together.
Thank you.
Thank you for your talk and for your government service, and I really appreciate that you're speaking up for government workers and service that you did.
State your name.
My name's Michael Pittman. I'm a community member. I think I'll just ask the one question. It's kind of not something that you just talked about, but it's about the ocean. I read the New York Times and science magazines and things like that. And over the years, one of the questions that I've been wondering about is how wise it is to mine the ocean for rare earth minerals. I heard that there's a big swath of the ocean in international waters that startups perhaps would like to get their hands on. And I don't know how wise or good or bad that would be. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Thank you for your question. Thank you for your comments. Deep sea mining is being touted increasingly as the solution to a green transition by the mining companies that want to mine the minerals that are on the deep sea, either in crusts or nodules or other kinds of forms. I'm of the mind that we need more information to know whether it can be done safely and without harming the pretty amazing deep sea communities that are there. There's a lot of life down there. Every time people look, they find a whole bunch of things they didn't even know existed. And we should not be mining down there until we know that it is that we can do so in ways that aren't damaging. So that is, it's also super expensive. It's not really likely to happen soon, but there's a lot of talk about it. And there's an international organization that is responsible for making the rules on this, that is undergoing sort of a change in leadership, and they will be, I think, providing, it's not clear what direction they're heading, but that is an organization that the U.S. does not belong to, because we haven't ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty, so we don't belong to this International Seabed Authority. And so that's yet one more reason for the U.S. to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty so that we can be at those international conversations. But I'm with the people, this is not any official pronouncement, this is my personal view, that we should have a moratorium on deep sea mining until we have more information to know whether we can do it in ways that are not destructive. Thank you all for staying. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you. Great questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.